NPR.com/NPR.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night, which airs on WEDU-TV. It's the roundtable panel discussion about state and local politics. We'll hear that first, and then we'll dive deeper into the controversy surrounding the South Florida Congresswoman and the White House Chief of Staff. That's later on in the program when we open up the phone lines. As we listen back to Florida This Week, you can email your comments into the studio here at dj@wmnf.org. Here is Florida This Week. Coming up next, a white supremacist is met by thousands of anti-racist demonstrators on the campus of the University of Florida in Gainesville.
We don't want your Nazi hate!
A Miami soldier's death produced the controversy over President Trump and Gold Star families. Will the arrival of Puerto Ricans fleeing from hurricane destruction tip the political balance in Florida? And the powerful Constitution Revision Commission decides to reject most of the public's input. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
From the WEDU studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Loray.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are Josh Gillen is a writer for PolitiFact and the Tampa Bay Times. Barry Edwards is a political strategist and a commentator and a Democrat. Deborah Tamargo is chair of the Hillsborough County Republican Party. And Professor Tara Newsom is the director for civic learning and community engagement at St. Petersburg College. Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you for coming. Well, in his first major public appearance since this summer's violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, white supremacist Richard Spencer spoke to a group of several dozen of his supporters and hundreds of opponents on the University of Florida campus in Gainesville. Spencer talked about his ideal of creating a whites-only nation, but his speech was interrupted by chants and taunts from anti-fascist protesters. Outside, thousands of people marched to protest Spencer's racist views. Governor Scott had declared a state of emergency in advance of Spencer's speech, and hundreds of law enforcement officers were in town to prevent violence. So, Josh, what did you make of the event on Thursday?
Well, I mean, frankly, what I got out of it was, and not to make light of the situation, but it was a whole lot of nothing happening, you know, really. I mean, that was pretty phenomenal, especially after Charlottesville this summer, right? That Gainesville actually, you know, responded. The university had some controversy, had to let Spencer speak here, but, you know, it really, you had Spencer there saying that the protesters had failed. That was the last thing he said when he left the stage. You failed, but they had, I feel like they had shouted him down, and there was only, I believe, two arrests throughout the day. So, you know, it's really the big story is that it wasn't a bigger story.
So was it a success for any side?
Well, I mean, I think when you're talking about the protesters, if you can shout down the person you're protesting, which in effect is what they did, I would say they won. Yeah.
Deborah, what did you make of the event?
Well, I think the protesters definitely won. And this was a support of the First Amendment. OK. But at the same time, it was the free market showing Spencer and those like him that he's not acceptable. That is not mainstream for any of us. And I really like the fact that the beer brewery was offering free beer as an alternative. He definitely failed. There were very few people at his rally, and most of them were there to protest him, not to agree with him.
Tara, the president of UF was kind of rankled because his security costs for this were $600,000, and he said just before the event that we're essentially subsidizing, this racist speech with the $600,000.
You know what? I commend the University of Florida and actually the entire Gainesville community and what they did. They behaved beautifully in the sense that it was a horrible situation in which they graciously adhered to the law. And a $600,000 investment compared to what would have cost for one life that had been lost is a minor investment. And really, they had no other choice than to be prepared for what was Charlottesville in Gainesville. And so I think that investment, although spread out among the taxpayers, is unfortunate. It certainly was the only thing that they had a choice to do, especially in light of the Supreme Court report this last June saying, listen, content regulation cannot happen. So they had nothing else to do but allow for Spencer to be at UF.
And Barry, Spencer, I think, was hoping that this would set off a chain of speeches around the country by which he could build his movement. And what, you know, does this help or hurt that cause of Spencer's?
I think that we're going to look back in 2 years, 5 years, that this was the turning point, that Charlottesville was actually an aberration because they weren't prepared. Here they were prepared, and I got to commend the governor. I'm not usually somebody that says Rick Scott does a good job by declaring a state of emergency. I talked to a National Guard officer. They were there with rifles, and people knew that you couldn't do nonsense. But this is going to be a turning point. It shows that what Deborah said, there isn't, not mainstream, it's not even the extreme. We're talking about a very tiny percentage of people actually hold his views. And, you know, the protesters could have, you know, swearing doesn't really help their cause because it makes them look just as bad. But they were pretty well restrained. There were only one or two arrests. But I think this was the turning point. And if you walked across campus, Century Tower, which has a reputation for a lot of things, was playing a Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is also known as the Negro National Anthem. And I think people were uplifted and people were talking. I talked to several people that were actually in law enforcement up there, and they were surprised how people that normally wouldn't have interacted got together. This was a turning point. Loser for the alt-right or whatever he is. And I think that it shows that America really is better than people might think on the extremes.
All right, well, firestorm of controversy this week involving President Trump and another military family, this one in Miami. A South Florida congresswoman, Democrat Frederica Wilson, said that President Trump told the widow of a soldier killed in an ambush in Niger that her husband knew what he signed up for, seemingly expressing indifference over the soldier's death. The president's chief of staff, John Kelly, himself a Gold Star dad, fought back, saying he was stunned and brokenhearted by the congresswoman's comments. He called her an empty barrel.
Let me tell you what my best friend, Joe Dunford, told me, because he was my casualty officer. He said, Kel, he was doing exactly what he wanted to do when he was killed. He knew what he was getting into by joining that 1%. He knew what the possibilities were because we're at war.
The congresswoman responded the next day.
We feel for you just like we feel for LaDavid's parents and LaDavid's wife. You have my deepest sympathy, but I would never say to you, your son knew what he was signing up for. That would not be a part of my sympathy message to you.
Sergeant LaDavid Johnson was among four servicemen killed in the African nation of Niger earlier this month. They died when militants, thought to be affiliated with the Islamic State, ambushed them while they were patrolling in unarmored trucks with Nigerian troops. U.S. air support did not immediately respond, and Johnson's body was recovered 2 days later. So, Tara, is the congresswoman here trying to gain political points, or did the White House mishandle this, or what do you make of this?
I think the story here is less about whether Donald Trump said it or not. General Kelly came out and revealed that he mentored the president to make these comments, and that other sources have also confirmed that different presidents over different times have handled correspondence, the unimaginable call to these families that have paid the ultimate sacrifice in different ways. But the story here is really about the lack of trust and the disorientation of the American people with the president, unsure of how to accept his type of politicizing the death of one of our most revered soldiers. And that disorientation is causing ripples and a distrust in our entire electorate. So I think it's less about whether Representative Wilson actually heard the call or not. That seems to be the case. It seems to be factually accurate. But what seems more upsetting is this lack of trust between the American people and the presidency.
Deborah, what do you make of that? I mean, do you think that the president is disorienting the American people and that there's a lack of trust for the president on the part of the American people?
Well, certainly not on the part of the military. There is a lack of trust with Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who would politicize, would take a conversation she heard that was a private conversation, take segments of it. Obviously, it was not the entire conversation. And she herself, who has such a poor record on the military and veterans, she voted against our government paying for the funerals of these war victims. And that is obscene, since she, as a member of Congress, would have her funeral taken care of if she died in office. She also voted against the VA, the whistleblower, the VA funding and military funding. So I think it was very disingenuous, and you don't politicize a death in any way, shape, or form. She opened the conversation, and she was wrong.
Barry?
I think this right there, this is right. It's not about Trump. It's not about Frederica Wilson. It's about the four soldiers that passed and their families. My nephew was in Afghanistan. He's still there as a private contractor. And every day, my sister woke up when he was in combat, wanted to know if that was his last day. And it doesn't matter whether Trump intended it or not. I don't think he intended to be offensive. I think he was trying to do the Churchillian, apparently. Churchill used to have a when he would call the fallen soldiers' families, say, you know, your son wanted to be in combat and all that, the machismo aspect. But it doesn't matter how it was, what is important is how it was received. The mother didn't receive it that way. Frederica Wilson was riding. It wasn't a private conversation. She was in the car. She wasn't list eavesdropping. And it doesn't matter what else you voted on. Let's talk about the soldier. Trump should have said the presidential thing to do would have been said, I'm sorry I offended you. I really thank you for the sacrifice for your son and for your family. And ended it. The whole thing, and this is why President Trump is having problems outside his base. He gets off on all these tangents, and then he's attacking Frederica Wilson, who's known for her hats, as all hat and no cattle. I mean, it's cute and clever, but this is the same thing with the protesters. We need to ratchet down the rhetoric and look at, why don't we talk about the soldier and his death and honor that? And also, where are my Republican friends who were all wrapped up in Benghazi after investigation after investigation after investigation? Why aren't they amped up and say, why did it take 2 days to get these kids' bodies? That's what I want to know.
And they absolutely have opened that investigation. You missed yesterday's news.
I would love just to add one piece here, and that is the fact that no one's talking about the fact that our president asked his his chief of staff to go out and reveal something as personal as the loss of his own son. So if you take a large step back, don't talk about the politicalization of the death, but think about the tenor of the presidency and what he's putting his own people in. I think there is some real issues there.
I think the president hoped that by putting John Kelly out there on Thursday that this would end it, because Kelly's story is so powerful, but it didn't end it. The controversy continued even after Thursday, even after Kelly's powerful description of his son and all these soldiers who come back the way his son came back.
I'm sorry, it worked really well.
Yeah. Josh, has PolitiFact looked into any of the events, or maybe too soon for PolitiFact to have looked into any of the events surrounding the death of Sergeant Johnson?
Right. A lot of that is still, you know, being investigated. Things are being looked at here. What it's really doing is elevating, you know, Wilson's profile here, right? She has become a central figure that I don't think a lot of people had really heard from before. And really, you know, I have to agree with pretty much everything the rest of the panel said. You know, I mean, there are portions of this that do raise these issues. It's interesting to me, first of all, that, you know, Kelly goes out and attacks Wilson, all right, and says the things that he said about her, and this becomes this political issue instead of, you know, as you said, why didn't the president just stop and say, oh, I'm sorry, something I said offended you, you know? And I think that could have...
The president doesn't back down. I mean, no, he doesn't right. like to back down. He likes to counterpunch. He doesn't ever leave a battle.
Right.
He always fights back.
And this is, definitely one of those cases. And I think, you know, if you're looking for, I think we've seen a record that the empathy is not necessarily something a lot of pundits say that he expresses on a regular basis.
Now, if I'm right, the congresswoman wears the hats to honor her grandmother. This is something that she's done ever since she's in office. She's just not wearing a hat for the sake of wearing a hat. This is something
right.
to honor
she's
one of her relatives.
Florida Senate and the Florida House.
Right. All right. Well, Florida Democrats are trying
nice
to...
Nice woman.
All right. Florida Democrats are trying to capitalize on the predicted arrival of people from storm-battered Puerto Rico with a voter registration effort that they hope will turn into an advantage in next year's statewide elections.
The state's exploding Puerto Rican population, clustered primarily here in Central Florida, has proved reliably Democratic over the past decade. if, as Puerto Rico's commissioner in Congress has suggested, as many as 500,000 of the island's residents might move to the mainland as a result of Hurricane Maria's impacts, tens of thousands could settle here in Florida and become eligible voters. At a San Juan press conference last weekend, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson suggested that registering newly arrived Puerto Ricans will be one of his campaign's top priorities. But the influx of Puerto Ricans may be offset by the arrival of predominantly Republican voters in another part of Central Florida, that is, the Villages. Located in three counties, Sumter, Lake, and Marion, the Villages is the fastest growing metro area in the U.S. The majority of its residents are Republicans. In 2012, Mitt Romney won the three counties by 76,000 votes. In 2016, Trump widened that margin, winning by 115,000.
So, Deborah, I can almost hear the Democrats cheering, saying, bring on the people from Puerto Rico because they want to sign them up as voters. You think that there will be a mass influx of Puerto Ricans, and will they sign up to vote, and will they vote Democratic?
Well, there certainly will be a mass influx. I think it was very disingenuous of Senator Nelson to go to Puerto Rico during a tragedy and again politicize a tragedy by announcing in Puerto Rico that his main concern was just registering all these people as Democrats, not the concern about the supply chain or any of the other issues. And I think he is wrong to assume that they will register Democrats when, in fact, the largest area affected with the highest population was San Juan area. And their mayor did a very poor job. In fact, out of the 78 mayors in Puerto Rico, she was the only one that was not coordinating and collaborating with FEMA, and consequently there were shipments of food that were thrown away. She was not distributing, whereas in other parts of Puerto Rico, the supply chain was working well, the coordination. FEMA was there before the storm, during the storm, and after the storm, and she was the only one not collaborating, and people within her area did suffer.
So she was the most critical of President Trump and his administration's handling of this.
Yes.
But the complaint that we often hear is that the aid gets into Puerto Rico, but it hasn't been able to get out to the countryside. I spoke to somebody this week who has relatives in Puerto Rico. They say it's still true that the aid is not getting out to the countryside. Barry, what would you say? Will the Democrats reap the benefits of this tragedy in Puerto Rico? That is, will Puerto Ricans move to Florida in big numbers and change the makeup of the electorate?
Well, I think the debate, the question is how many move and how long they stay. But in the short term, it's absolutely a benefit. If they come, Democrats vote for Democrats, Republicans vote for Republicans, and they don't care how the mayor of San Juan behaved, if you've got a history of voting one way or the other. So when they come here, and it doesn't take a lot. Remember, the last four elections in Florida for president and for governor were 1% elections, 0.6 to 0.1.
So you just need a little bit of change in the electorate either way. But then does the Villages...
80,000.
Okay, but does the Villages, changes. The influx of people to the Villages, does that offset any advantage that might come from the Puerto Rican influx?
Or you could say that this is offsetting the rampant growth in Central Florida to this Gulf community. And it is mostly Republican and mostly white. 73% of the electorate in 2014, when Governor Chris lost for his to come back for governor, 73% of the voters in that gubernatorial cycle were white. And so that's one of the things keeping the white vote up. The Puerto Ricans obviously are Hispanic, and they are Democratic. So this could offset it. But you know, it's a competition. How many people want to go golfing in Central Florida versus how many Puerto Ricans? This is going to be a surge that nobody else expected because of the tragedy. You get 40, 50, 60,000. Remember, Governor Scott, what was his first election over Alex Sink? 60,000 votes. You get 61,000 Puerto Ricans. You got a Democratic governor named Gwen Graham.
Josh, anything you want to add to this discussion about whether or not the Villages or Puerto Rican influx is more important to the changing electorate?
Well, I want to go back to what we were talking about with the ports. You know, I mean, there has been a lot of issues on the entire island with how the storm had been responded to here, and it's become a really big issue. I am actually pretty curious among our analyst friends here as to whether or not there aren't some Republicans there who are a little unhappy with the response, with the way that this U.S. territory was treated after the storm. And yes, I did write about several fake news items that did say that there were problems getting things out of the ports. One of them was because unions were on strike. That wasn't true.
The Teamsters were not on strike. Is that news item?
And actually, the unions were going out and saying, please come into work. The truck drivers just could not get to the port, and the trucks couldn't get out of San Juan.
Deborah,
well, if you were to understand Spanish, are there any Spanish speakers? And I'm listening to...
We do have a Spanish speaker on staff who watch these.
I listen to radio shows, and the president of the Teamsters, I listened to an extended radio interview with him, and he said, we are prepared to deliver. However, it will only be on our terms and not according to FEMA regulations. So there was a non-strike strike going on, and I think it's also kind of demeaning to Puerto Ricans to assume that they will come here and vote Democratic. Also, regarding the supply chain, the largest Puerto Rican relief group was Course of Action Foundation, which I volunteer for, and that's Colonel Otero, Colonel Oliva, and a number of other former veterans who are experts in delivering, and they were actually planning during the storm, and they have been very successful getting their shipments of generators and so forth throughout Puerto Rico, coming in different ports and distributed through their people. And you know, the last really comment on that is that there was a lot of obstruction and a lot of politicizing. If you've worked in Puerto Rico, as I have, you recognize what that road condition, and I actually worked on the chain of survival, so I had to assess the chain of survival throughout Puerto Rico. And it would sometimes take an ambulance to get to a victim, whether it was a car crash or a heart attack, 30 minutes or never. And so that is a very challenging situation.
I want to ask you one quick question. That is, President Trump this week was asked what marks he would give himself for how he conducted relief in Puerto Rico.
He did.
And he gave himself a 10.
He did.
He said
he did.
10
he did.
Out of a scale
and
of 10.
The Puerto Ricans that were interviewed gave him a 0. And that is because it does not matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're not treated like a United States citizen and are not afforded even help getting infrastructure like electricity back, it's really hard to offer your president congratulations. We have individuals drinking water out of Superfund sites. So I think individuals that are coming to Florida, you know, 27,000 have come to Florida since October 3rd. We're looking at close to 500,000 Puerto Ricans before 2020. To discount the fact that they won't affect our election cycle as soon as 2018 is ridiculous. All they need is 30 days. These are American citizens that just have to register to vote.
Okay.
And they will remember the fact that the current administration did not treat them kindly.
All right. Well, the public body responsible for updating Florida's constitution rejected all but 6 of the more than 2,000 ideas proposed by the public.
This after the Constitution Revision Commission spent months gathering public input. Every 20 years, the CRC gets together to decide which proposed constitutional amendments will go on the ballot, and what the commission approves will eventually be put before the voters next year. Among the measures already rejected, limiting money in politics and limiting donations to political committees, establishing religious protections for businesses, creating a state commission on sea level rise, electing the Public Service Commission, and legalizing marijuana.
So, Barry, was this CRC different than the one 20 years ago? 20 years ago, did they pay attention to the public?
Dexter Douglas was the chairman of the committee 20 years ago and was a statesman, and they did listen to the public. They had, I think, 10 times. No, I think we only took 8 so far, so like 20 times the number of public measures that they actually debated. It was really disappointing, and I'm friends with Carlos Baruff, and so Carlos
is
the chairman of this. Don't get mad at me, because I had this conversation with you on the phone a couple days ago. To have a 20-minute meeting when you've had all 9 months of meetings that have 2,100 public recommendations out of 20 minutes to kill all of them, I think is a little disrespectful to the public.
Why should the public care whether or not their ideas get on the ballot next year? Why should they care?
Well, this is normally to get a measure on the ballot, it costs $5 to $10 million to get an amendment, you know, like marijuana or whatever you want to do for your signatures. We're having trouble with the amendment to try to get felon restoration. They're going to fall short, in my opinion. And that's why we need the Constitutional Revision Commission to be able to put things that are important on the ballot and change the policy
it
of the state.
Felon restoration, was that considered by the CRC?
It is. In fact, Senator Roussan has two bills I think they're really interesting. He's the only elected Democrat on the commission. His first bill is he actually is going to drain the swamp. He proposed banning lobbying for elected legislators and executives for 6 years after they get out of office, and he wants to change the way we do felon restoration.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? And Barry, let's start with you.
Well, good news for Democrats in the Tampa Bay area. Last night in Las Vegas, the Democratic National Committee elected Alan Clendenin, the chairman of the Southern Caucus, which is the old Confederacy plus West Virginia, and they also elected him to the executive board of the Democratic National Committee. So a big get for the Democrats from the Tampa Bay area.
And sometimes panelists on this show, too.
And sometimes panelists.
Tara, your other big story.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about Puerto Ricans and their impact on the Florida electorate, and Barry brought light to the fact that we may not have the ballot initiative to enfranchise felons, but we may have a new governor who might be more sensitive to clemency. And if we do have that new governor, that will dramatically affect the razor-thin margins of the 2020 statewide elections.
Prediction about who that new governor might be? Okay. All right. Deborah, your other big story.
The Buccaneers have won the opportunity to bring the Super Bowl here in 2020. And I find that very interesting. Why? Because we have heard from so many city officials and so many people that have backed the tax referendums that Hillsborough County, Tampa Bay would never get another Super Bowl. We'd never get another political convention or major corporation. But yet Tampa Bay continues to get major corporations and the Super Bowl, which shows it's not about having all these wires overhead for light rail, but it's really about the community that we have today.
All right, Josh, your other big story.
Okay, and I knew this was going to come up real quick. The CRC 20 years ago, 128 proposals that they took on instead of the 6 that they did this year. And my other one was going to be that the Senate Finance Committee has agreed to investigate those deaths at the nursing home after Hurricane Irma in Hollywood.
A federal investigation.
Bill Nelson announced it, but Marco Rubio also supported an investigation. So we're going to wait for that one.
Well, thank you all for a wonderful show. And thanks for watching Florida This Week.
That was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV, public television here in the Tampa Bay area. And my guests on that program were Josh Gillen, who writes for PolitiFact and the Tampa Bay Times. Deborah Tamargo is chair of the Hillsborough Republican Party. Barry Edwards is a Democratic strategist. And Tara Newsom is a professor at St. Pete College. Those were my guests. Well, we're going to pick up on one of the topics that we just heard about there on Florida This Week. And as I play back the sound from this past week, I hope you'll email us and call us and tell us what you think about this topic. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. The topic, of course, the conflict between Congresswoman Frederica Wilson from Miami and the White House. Miami Times reported last week that Congresswoman Wilson is under protection after getting death threats after she accused Donald Trump of making insensitive remarks to the grieving widow of a Miami Gardens Special Forces soldier who was killed in Niger. The Congresswoman said the calls started last Wednesday at her offices in Miami and Washington, D.C. She said the calls said we're going to get her, and she blamed the threats on far-right people who support Mr. Trump. Well, this controversy began last Monday when President Trump was asked about the 4 soldiers who were killed in Niger. Let's listen to what President Trump said a week ago.
Anything from you so far about the soldiers that were killed in Niger, and what do you have to say about
this? I've written them personal letters. They've been sent, or they're going out tonight, but they were written during the weekend. I will, at some point during the period of time, call the parents and the families, because I have done that traditionally. I felt very, very badly about that. I always feel badly. It's the toughest calls I have to make. Are the calls where this happens, soldiers are killed. It's a very difficult thing. Now, it gets to a point where, you know, you make 4 or 5 of them in one day is a very, very tough day. For me, that's by far the toughest. So the traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it. They have made the ultimate sacrifice. So generally, I would say that I like to call. I'm going to be calling them. I want a little time to pass. I'm going to be calling them. I have, as you know, since I've been president, I have. But in addition, I actually wrote letters individually to the soldiers we're talking about, and they're going to be going out either today or tomorrow.
Well, that was President Trump last week at the start of this controversy, saying that he calls all the families of the soldiers killed, and said additionally that he writes them too. The Associated Press looked at that, and it found of the families it was able to contact of the 43 soldiers killed so far since January, since President Trump became president. About half of the families they were able to get in touch with said the president had indeed contacted them, either by writing or calling, but the other half said that he had not contacted them. This morning it's being reported that those families that so far have not been contacted by the president now are about to receive letters from President Trump. Well, one of the people who got a phone call was Maisha Johnson. She was on her way to greet the casket of her husband last Monday in Miami, and Congresswoman Frederica Wilson overheard the phone call between the president and Maisha Johnson. So this is what Congresswoman Wilson told reporters about the president's call last Monday.
I know this is the first time that you're hearing the president's tweet read to you. So when he says that you've totally fabricated what he said to the wife of the soldier, and he has proof, what's your response?
Well, I don't know what kind of proof he could be talking about. I'm not the only person that was in the car. And I have proof, too. This man is a sick man. He's cold-hearted, and he feels no pity or sympathy for anyone. This is a grieving widow who is 6 months pregnant. This is a young woman. She's only 24 years old. She weighs maybe 110 pounds, and she has two other kids, 2 years old and 6 years old. And when she actually hung up the phone, she looked at me and said, he didn't even know his name. So now, that's the worst part.
So, Congressman, let's talk about that. What did you hear? Tell us about this phone call.
Well, I didn't hear the whole phone call, but I did hear him say, I'm sure he knew what he was signing up for. And but it still hurts.
So that's how you interpreted it. You interpreted it as the president saying something callous in that way. Obviously, it can be heard lots of different ways. It could be heard as the president trying to find some point of understanding to speak out to the widow. How did she hear it? What was her response?
She was crying. She broke down, and she said, he didn't even know his name. So this,
did you hear that part? Did you hear the part where it left the impression that he didn't know his name?
She heard the part that he didn't know his name. And I don't think we should be trying to go into all of this. What the concern is, we have a soldier who died from Miami Gardens. And there are so many circumstances surrounding his death that I still have questions about.
That's Miami Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, a Democrat, talking to Allison Camerota on CNN about the growing controversy over what President Trump said to the widow of LaDavid Johnson. The widow's name is Maisha Johnson. So the chief of staff of the White House, John Kelly, then was sent out last week after the controversy started to the White House press room to defend the president. And he told reporters his advice to President Trump has always been, don't make the phone call.
Some presidents have elected to call. All presidents, I believe, have elected to send letters. If you elect to call a family like this, it is about the most difficult thing you could imagine. There's no perfect way to make that phone call. When I took this job and talked to President Trump about how to do it, my first recommendation was he not do it. because it's not the phone call that parents, family members are looking forward to. It's a nice to do, in my opinion, in any event. He asked me about previous presidents, and I said I can tell you that President Obama, who was my commander-in-chief when I was on active duty, did not call my family. That was not a criticism. That was just to simply say, I don't believe President Obama called. That's not a negative thing.
White House Chief of Staff John Kelly sent out to speak with reporters last week, telling reporters his advice to President Trump was don't make the phone call. Now, President Trump was on Fox News that very morning saying that he did make phone calls to the families of dead soldiers.
This was, again, fake news CNN. I mean, they're just a bunch of fakers. So they asked me that question, and for the most part, to best of my knowledge, I think I've called every family of somebody that's died, and it's the hardest call to make, and I said it very loud and clear yesterday. The hardest thing for me to do is do that. Now, as far as other representatives, I don't know. I mean, you could ask General Kelly, did he get a call from Obama? You could ask other people. I don't know what Obama's policy was. I write letters, and I also call.
President Trump saying that he's called every soldier's family. We learned the same day the president said that from the Associated Press that of the families that they were able to contact, the president had not contacted about half the families of that. They reached out to all 43 of the soldiers' families who had been killed since the start of the presidency. And about half said, who replied to the Associated Press, about half said that they had not heard anything from the president, neither a phone call nor a letter. Well, General Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, was very upset that Congresswoman Wilson had heard the president's phone call last Monday to Sergeant Johnson's family. And when he came out to reporters at the White House press room, this is what he had to say. This is White House Chief of Staff John Kelly.
It stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation. Absolutely stuns me. And I thought at least that was sacred. And a congresswoman stood up, and in the long tradition of empty barrels making the most noise, stood up there and all of that, and talked about how she was instrumental in getting the funding for that building.
So John Kelly saying that he was stunned that the congresswoman had listened in on the phone call, and then criticizing her for taking credit for getting funding for an FBI building. Now, Congresswoman Wilson responded to Kelly last week, and also we're going to hear part of Congresswoman Wilson's 2015 speech in which she talks about that very FBI building and what her role was in that building. Listen carefully. This is Congresswoman Frederica Wilson.
I heard his remarks, and I heard him say that I bragged that I secured the money for the building of the FBI building in Miramar. He can't just go on TV and lie on me. I was not even in Congress in 2009 when the money for the building was secured. So that's a lie. How dare he?
It takes at least 8 months to a year to complete the process. And I said, excuse my French. Oh, hell no.
This is a speech from 2015.
We're gonna get this done. I may, well, all men and women and first responders who work in law enforcement, stand up. Stand up now so that we can applaud you and what you do. Stand up.
Well, that was Congresswoman Frederica Wilson in a speech at a dedication for an FBI building in 2015, in which she talks about what it took to get the naming rights on the building, but she took no credit for the funding. And she pointed out in the interview last week that she was not even in Congress in 2009 when the building got funded. So the White House press spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee, was asked about this controversy, including what John Kelly said about Wilson taking credit for getting money for the FBI building. She was asked about this last Friday at the White House press briefing. Here's the White House spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
The South Florida Sun Sentinel released a video of Congresswoman Wilson's speech in 2015. In the speech, it doesn't appear that she referenced funding for the FBI building in South Florida. Does General Kelly still stand by the statement that he made yesterday that he felt that she was grandstanding and that she was taking credit?
Absolutely. General Kelly said he was stunned that Representative Wilson made comments at a building dedication honoring slain FBI agents about her own actions in Congress, including lobbying former President Obama on legislation. As General Kelly pointed out, if you're able to make a sacred act like honoring American heroes all about yourself, you're an empty barrel. If you don't understand that reference, I'll put it a little more simply. As we say in the South, all hat, no cattle.
Well, in fact, have you seen the speech?
I have.
And then you know that most of it was her effusively praising these FBI agents. And when she was talking about what she did in Congress, she was not talking about securing $20 million. She was talking about naming the building
for these FBI agents,
who she then went on to effusively praise.
That
was the bulk of the speech.
She also mentioned that, and she also had quite a few comments that day that weren't part of that speech and weren't part of that video that were also witnessed by many people that were there. What General Kelly referenced yesterday.
Tell us specifically, because
exactly what he said. There was a lot of grandstanding. He was stunned that she had taken that opportunity to make it about herself.
Can he come out here and talk to us about this at some point?
I think he's addressed that pretty thoroughly yesterday.
No, he was wrong yesterday in talking about getting the money. The money was
secured. If you want to go after General Kelly, that's up to you. But I think that if you want to get into a debate with a 4-star Marine general, I think that's something highly inappropriate.
White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying that standing by General Kelly's description of what happened, also keeping Kelly under wraps, not providing him to the press, and suggesting that reporters should not question a 4-star general. What do you think about this? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. The Congresswoman was back on TV on Saturday morning, and this is what she had to say about the controversy involving what happened to Sergeant LaDavid Johnson and the White House reaction to it. Here is, once again, Congresswoman Frederica Wilson.
This is going to be this administration's Benghazi. This is going to be Trump's Benghazi, Trump's Niger.
All right, so what do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. The widow of the fallen soldier, LaDavid Johnson, the widow's name is Maisha Johnson. She was on Good Morning America this morning. Let's listen in on what she said to George Stephanopoulos this morning in her first interview since the controversy arose. And we're going to get this for you in a second. And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to, I'm going to read some of these emails that have come in. James writes this: "It appears the stench of Trump is on John Kelly. Now he's lost my respect." That's James's email. What do you think? 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. We're going to get this sound on in just a moment, so stick around. And we're going to take a music break right now. And we're going to get hear the interview that Maisha Johnson, the widow of fallen soldier Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, did in just a moment. Okay, so here is the interview with Maisha Johnson that aired this morning on ABC TV.
Thank you for coming in this morning. I hope you're feeling the prayers and thoughts of all of us.
Yes.
You know, it was so clear watching the funeral how loved and respected LaDavid was by his family, his friends, his community, his fellow soldiers. What do you want people to know about him?
Well, I want the world to know how great of a soldier my husband was.
and a loving and caring father and husband he was to our family.
You knew him since you were six, huh?
Yes, sir.
And I also know you have a lot of questions about what happened.
Yes.
In Niger.
Yes.
What's at the top of your mind?
The questions that I have that I need answered is, I want to know why it took them 48 hours to find my husband. Why couldn't I see my husband? Every time I asked to see my husband, they wouldn't let me.
What did they tell you?
They're telling me that he's in a severe rap. Like, I won't be able to see him. I need to see him so I will know that that is my husband. I don't know nothing. They won't show me a finger, a hand. I know my husband's body from head to toe. And they won't let me see anything. I don't know what's in that box. It could be empty for all I know. But I need to see my husband. I haven't seen him since he came home.
And what have they told you about what happened in Africa?
I really don't know the answers to that one neither, because when they came to my house, they just told me that it was a massive gunfire and my husband, as of October 4th, was missing. They didn't know his whereabouts. They didn't know where he was or where to find him. And a couple of days later is when they told me that he went from missing to killed in action. I don't know how he got killed, where he got killed, or anything. I don't know that part. They never told me, and that's what I've been trying to find out since day one, since October 4th.
Are you confident you're going to get the answers you need?
If I keep pushing for him, I will.
And they just say they don't know?
They won't tell me. They won't tell me anything. I don't know anything.
There are also a lot of questions about the phone call you received from President Trump. I know you were in a car to the airport. Mm-hmm. Tell us what happened next.
Me and my family was in the limo to receive my husband from, I think that was Dover. And we was literally on the airport strip getting ready to get out. And he called Master Sergeant Neil's phone. I asked Master Sergeant Neil to put his phone on speaker so my aunt and uncle could hear as well. And he goes on to saying his statement as, what he said was...
The president.
Yes, the president said that he knew what he signed up for, but it hurts anyways. And it made me cry because I was very angry at the tone of his voice and how he said it. He couldn't remember my husband's name. The only way he remembered my husband's name because he told me he had my husband report in front of him. And that's when he actually said, LaDavid. I heard him stumbling on trying to remember my husband's name. And that would hurt me the most, because if my husband is out here fighting for our country and he risked his life for our country, why can't you remember his name? And that would make me upset and cry even more, because my husband was an awesome soldier. He did what it takes people, other soldiers, like 5 years to do in 3 years. So imagine if my husband was here now. It took my husband 3 years to make E5. It takes other soldiers 5 to 6 years just to make an E5. So if he was here now, he would have been on his way to being an E6 or an E7. My husband had high hopes in the military career.
What did you say to the president?
I didn't say anything. I just listened.
But you were upset when you got off the phone.
Oh, very, very upset and hurt. Very. It made me cry even worse.
Congresswoman Wilson reported that, and you explained she was in the car with you.
Yes.
She's been close to your family for a long time.
Yes. Yes. Miss Wilson, my uncle-in-law was Miss Wilson's elementary school principal. And my husband was in her 5,000 role model program. That's why she's well connected with us, because she's been in our family since we were little kids.
The president said that the congresswoman was lying about the phone call.
Whatever Ms. Wilson said was not fabricated. What she said was 100% correct. It was Master Sergeant Neal, me, my aunt, my uncle, and the driver, and Ms. Wilson in the car. The phone was on speakerphone. Why would we fabricate something like that?
Is there anything you'd like to say to the president now?
No. I don't have nothing to say to him.
Your little girl's going to be born in January.
Yes, January 29th.
What are you going to tell her about her dad?
I'm going to tell her how awesome her dad was and how a great father he was and how he died as a hero.
Word she's going to love to hear. Maisha, thank you for sharing your story this morning.
Thank you.
It was Maisha Johnson, who is the widow of LaDavid Johnson, the one of four soldiers killed in Niger earlier this month. The handling of the phone call to the Johnson family by President Trump has created quite a controversy. So let's open up the phone lines. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. And Frank Knox is our phone producer today. Several emails have already come in. Edward writes this. He says, what a shame this sick, powerful man without a conscience has chosen to use this beautiful lady who's been active in Miami area in mentoring young men and women since 1993. She personally mentored LaDavid Johnson through his youth. She is not playing politics. This young man and his family have been close friends of this congresswoman. As his mentor through his teenager years must have done something right, she mentored a young man who became a sergeant in the Green Berets at the age of 26 and died in the performance of his duty. That only happens to people who are raised up properly. Our country would be much better off if Mr. Trump had such a mentoring when he was a child. That's Ed in Largo, part of his email. And Jane writes this regarding whether or not a reporter should be able to question the White House chief of staff, who is a retired four-star general. Jane in Odessa writes, aren't we the taxpayers paying the salary of our military? That's Jane. And then this email from 941 says, man, as General Kelly was a Marine, as fiercely loyal as all Marines are, I being one also, proves to me that his opinion might be very low of the man that he serves, but he is a Marine and always will be in the servitude of the president to matter what opinion he has. His duty is to serve, writes somebody, his name is JFK. Well, let's take some phone calls. You are listening to WMNF in Tampa, 813-239-9663. Caller, I didn't get your name. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Well, real quick, I it's not a change in the subject, but I'm really more appalled when I was reading about the Niger ambush, about the actual reason why these soldiers got killed. And I just hope that maybe you can do a show on this or more people will look this up, because I had no idea how important Chad and their troops were to, stopping this spread of Islamic terrorism down there. And it was really an eye-opener when I think the article I read through Google was from CNN this morning. And it's almost hard to believe how directly the actions that took these lives was caused by this Trump administration suddenly adding Chad to the travel ban, and how important Chad was to fighting, because they've been trained by the French Legion going back over 35 years almost. And so that's my main thing, Rob. I just wanted to point that out.
All right, Kevin, thanks a lot. I haven't looked deeply into that. I know Rachel Maddow mentioned it the other night, but I'm not sure Rachel was exactly on target on that. But I will look and read more about it. Kevin, thanks a lot. Caller, you're on MNF. Thanks for calling. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Tony.
Hi, Tony. Where are you calling from?
Tampa area.
All right. What would you like to say?
Well, I got a couple of things. Number one, you know, it is terrible, this whole controversy, and, you know, I've always said this when I call up, I voted for Trump, and I would re-vote for Trump if I had to. But for me, the issue is, you know, the man put plenty of fodder out there for people to attack him on. I just hope that with your diligent coverage with the president, which has been wonderful, that we can maintain this same standard with every successor of this president and have the same scrutiny and incredulity that they probably all warrant in some way, shape, or form.
All right, Tony, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but thanks a lot. Thanks for your phone call. We didn't get a chance to get to all the other phone calls, but if you want to comment, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11. This is WM.